Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I'm a TV critic for Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, Vulture, and other publications where I cover Game of Thrones and other shows. I am the co-author of the official annotated to Game of Thrones with series editor Ann Grohl and Westeros.org and The World of Ice and Fire's Elio Garcia Jr. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones website located at BoiledLeather.com, which is the humble host of this podcast. And joining me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog at thenerdstremira.blogspot.com. And in recent news, as you may or may not hear, I actually fulfilled our Patreon pledge and got a new microphone, so hopefully this time the sound quality is a little bit better. So, Sean, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about what everybody's talking about today, Game of Thrones Season 6. Last night was the hopefully last night, if I'm getting this up in any kind of prompt way, was the season finale, The Winds of Winter. There's a whole lot to talk about in that episode, that's for sure. And I've done almost basically nothing but write about Game of Thrones for about 3 weeks. But I will kick it over to you first, Stefan. What did you think of either the finale or the season overall?
I actually think that season 6 is the best season since season 3, at least. I mean, it easily eclipses 4 and 5. It eclipses 2, in my opinion, so it's in the top 3. Now, I'm pleasantly surprised, because I thought initially the first few episodes weren't that good, but it really picked up steam, and the last 5, at least, were a blast, really. I definitely liked it very, very much. So that is the short version of it.
Yeah, I liked it too. I mean, that's no surprise if you've been reading what I've been writing. This show, more than perhaps any other that I write about, I feel like reacting to it on an episode-by-episode basis immediately is sort of over-determinative. Because you look for things that were really good, and you look for things that were not so good, and you try and figure out what that means for the season as a whole or the story as a whole. But this year I watched it with my fiance Julia, and I just got the sense that she was enjoying it a lot more on a moment-to-moment basis, and I think it's probably because she didn't have to write about it. I mean, you know, she certainly can talk about it in depth as well as anybody, but without having to make that, you know, snap judgment every week, which, don't get me wrong, I'm grateful to do for a living, you're able to just sort of take in what the show does well, the emotional intensity, the grandeur and spectacle of the imagery. You know, those kinds of things are present in even the worst episodes to one extent or another. And it's once I kind of saw that, I was like, you know, this is a show that I like. Whether or not, you know, everything in an individual episode is successful, or whatever the overall arc of a season or direction of a season is, you know, it's just a thing that I sit down knowing I'm going to enjoy myself, and then generally do. I know a lot of people don't feel that way. That's certainly how I feel, though.
I think that's a vocal minority who doesn't feel that way. I can see it every week because I'm also reviewing it like you do every week, just not as high profile. I also write a review right after I have watched the episode and then put it up, and I can definitely feel you on the snap judgments. So excuse for the sound out there, just that was a football game. So
this has happened to us once before, way back in the archives sometime. You guys just won the World Cup or something, and it sounded like riots were going on in the street. So
yes, we did. And I have no clue who played right now, but apparently the winner was good. So me and football, not a love story. So let's get back to topic. I think we will spend quite a lot of time today talking a little bit more about the meta aspect of Game of Thrones and watching Game of Thrones, because I have already started to talk about this a little bit the last time we were on discussing the mid-season point with Paul Quentin, that I really feel that it is extremely difficult right now as someone who has written extensive analysis on the books to watch the show and regard the show in any independent fashion, you know? Like, you're always unconsciously checking for what did they do differently and how did they keep in with this or that theme from the books and all that kind of stuff, you know? And as I already said, I have the feeling that I did fail a little bit as a critic on that part, because especially in the beginning of season six, I indulged a little bit too much in this criticism of stuff that's going different than in the books, and in many cases, like I imagine future books will be, which makes it a little bit more worse, actually. So this is something that you steered clear of. You know, every time I read your reviews, I thought, that's actually a good point, you know, and I hadn't seen it like this. And I was always impressed, like, you could separate your book knowledge from what you saw on screen, even when it touched really close to heart matters, like a certain monologue that was cut, you know.
I know that one.
Yeah. By the way, what did you think about how it turned out in the end?
That's a tough one. Well, first of all, I just want to say that I'm flattered that you feel that way about my writing. I did make a conscious choice at some point. Not originally. I mean, if you look back at the stuff I was just writing for my own blog in season one, and then some of the things I was saying even during season two, which is the first season that I reviewed it professionally for Rolling Stone, you know, I was making comparisons to the books. Even if I wasn't making it its way into the final piece that was getting published, I would then have some kind of separate comment on my personal blog or Boiled Leather, where I would say how I felt about it relative to the books, or how, you know, what my experience was like as a book reader. But I did make a choice at some point that I just have to write about this like it's a television show like any other, I would go nuts and I wouldn't get as much out of it, for better or for worse. It just wouldn't be as worthwhile an experience. I find myself much better served as a writer, whether I like something or not, to just take it as it is. So that's what I tried to do, I guess. And, you know, I think probably the changes to the Septon Maribald sequence and the monologue in particular was obviously as close to painful as any of the changes from the books have gotten for me. You know, I don't really stand for any particular character, so character differences didn't really make that huge a difference to me unless they were really dumb and not successful in their own terms. The storyline changes are the same, but, you know, that was really the heart of the books for me. I do still wish that they had found a way to incorporate it verbatim or close to verbatim, and I'm still iffy on how that storyline was handled. You know, it may be a situation like where it wasn't really their fault. You know, I know from having conversations with Brian Cogman, who wrote that episode, that it was not his intention to make Ray look foolish. He didn't think Ray was foolish in his pacifism, so it could be an issue of the execution not matching up with the intention. But ultimately, this is the same situation as it is with why I write about it, you know, irrespective of what happened in the books. I have to write about what I see on screen, and that's what I saw on screen. And, you know, knowing how the writers and filmmakers felt about it is a little bit of a relief, and in general, I think, borne out overall by how the series handles war and warfare and violence. But you know, so it's nice to know that they don't think Ray's ridiculous, and I do think the context bears that out. But, you know, in the moment, all that I can talk about is what I saw on screen, and that's what I saw on screen. It just seemed like he was made to look naive in a Walking Dead kind of way, which is not usually how the show handles that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I guess
that's how I felt about it. Yeah.
I mean, the later scene with the Hound when he walks into the Brotherhood kind of adds context to what happened to Ray, and at least gets rid of the Walking Dead vibe. But what you just said, you know, like, I can only judge what I see on screen. That is exactly the thing that's so difficult, you know, if you have read the books. So it really came to me like a little bit of an epiphany when I was about halfway through the season with my reviews, that I wasn't or haven't been able to do exactly that, you know, to judge the show on the show's own terms. It was always like, for example, if you look at the Northern plot, where you don't have all that politicking that you have in A Dance with Dragons, with those letters sent back and forth and the Manderleys making oaths on one hand, but secretly sending Davos on a mission on the other and all that kind of stuff. And it was more straightforward, you know, three houses against one house for, and let's go to battle. And then you are very tempted to say, like, the show really bungles that plot line because it lacks the thematic richness of the Northern politics material from Dance with Dragons. But maybe that wasn't even what they were going for, you know? I'm judging it on the basis of something that is that I expect to be there, but that simply isn't borne out by the things that are going on screen, you know? Like, for example, the political plot of A Dance with Dragons in the North, which has obviously been largely cut in the show. And if you expect it to be translated to the screen, what you see in political maneuvering on screen has to be disappointing in a huge degree. You know, like, for example, Stephen Atwell's reaction to last night's episode can, guess, I guess, a little bit be of an example for this, as he said, like, oh, the Manderleys are secretly loyal and they did the Frey Pies and it's not Arya. And of course, that's all true. But the Manderleys in the show are not the Manderleys in the book. And another example of this is Samwell Tarly, who steals Heartsbane in one of the earlier episodes. And there was also a lot of criticism, like, how can Samwell Tarly gather the courage to do actually something like this? And we have to keep in mind that show's Samwell Tarly has always been a little bit more cocky and self-confident than book Samwell Tarly. So those are not the same characters. And for the show, Sam stealing that sword to spite his father was actually quite in character. For book Sam, it would have been weird. Really, really weird. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I come back to Brienne because this was the first character I encountered where I really felt that the changes had been for the worse. Because Brienne, from the start, when we meet her in the show, is much angrier than her counterpart in the books and much more talented as a fighter than her counterpart in the books, simply because in the books they make a point of the fact that she has had no experience, because how would she get experience? She's a woman. You know, but by eventually, you know, you have things like Podrick saying she's the best swordsman, you know, I've ever seen, or sword fighter I've ever seen, however he put it. And you're just like, well, yeah, you know, she's really good. That's just how it works on the show.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. You know, it's a change, but I don't think it's a detrimental one, you know, and I think generally speaking, certain storylines become notorious because people who read the books almost unanimously feel that it's a change. It's not just a change from one thing to another thing. It's a change from one thing to something that's not as good. So, you know, I'm thinking of the Sand Snakes and Dorne in general. I'm thinking of Where Are My Dragons and Carth. I'm thinking of the business running around North of the Wall with Jon in season 2. You know, that things were changed, and I don't feel like we got anything of equal or greater compensatory value in exchange. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
All this being said, I will say this about this season, because it's a thing people ask me all the time when I have conversations with friends and family who don't read the books, and they ask, like, what's it like, you know, now that they're caught up with the books? How different is it? Like, is it completely out on its own? And one thing that surprised me is that the answer is kind of, well, yes and no. For one thing, significant storylines from this season were stuff that they had just skipped in previous seasons. So they still did have to catch up with what's been published. You know, that's, I'm thinking of Bran and the Iron Islands, however differently those were handled in the show than they are in the books. That was still them catching up with extant material from the novels. In a lot of other cases, they were catching up to things that are either in preview chapters from the Winds of Winter or things that are basically a foregone conclusion that we know they're going to happen. We know there's going to be a battle at Meereen because it's already happening in preview chapters. We know there's going to be a battle in the north against the Boltons, even if it's different forces involved, because that's being built to very clearly. We know that a trial is coming. We know that probably some fucked up shit's going to happen at the trial in King's Landing. We know that Jon's going to come back. We just don't know how. So it didn't feel like it was completely on its own and doing stuff that you had no idea was going to happen. The one exception, I think, was Hodor, which yes. came as a shock to everybody. But other than that, I still felt as a book reader, you know, and an especially devoted one who's consumed the preview chapters and really given a lot of thought to where the story is headed, I didn't feel like it was completely off on its own. Even if the configurations of characters were different, and even if the timing was different, you're still basically seeing things that you either have seen in the books or have seen in the preview chapters or would be willing to bet a substantial amount of money that you're going to see in the books, you know, within the opening sections of the Winds of Winter. So that kind of took me by surprise. I don't know. What do you think?
I actually think this is a good point to talk about spoilers, because I absolutely agree with what you've said so far, you know, about the structure. The show really arrives at the same points as the books do, just takes a different path, one that is sometimes quite as good, sometimes worse, sometimes even better than the books. But still, they arrive, I think, at the same conclusions. So the interesting thing for us as book readers, I guess, is how do we react to being spoiled for the first time? You know, in the previous time, we could always act as spoilers for guys who hadn't read the books. And I don't know how annoying we were in this, but and always like, ha ha, I knew this would happen. And, you know, so that's gone now. It is now, I thought this would happen and I'm feeling vindicated, you know, like that. But really, with the last episode, which finally confirmed the oldest fan theory of all, you know, which is R plus L equals J. So Lyanna and Rhaegar are the parents of Jon Snow.
Yeah.
This wasn't a spoiler, technically speaking. I think this isn't so much a theory anymore as a fact.
Yeah.
But now it is also canon in the show universe. So we always knew this was going to happen. We don't know exactly how it will play out, you know, but this doesn't really matter so much for reading The Winds of Winter and Dream of Spring later, because if Game of Thrones shows you one thing in its failures and in its successes, then it is that it is not the plot twist in and of itself that counts. It is the execution of it and the writing of it and the acting of it. The important thing is not what happens, but how. And this makes the spoiler problem for me pretty much irrelevant, because even though I get some more information from the show how certain plot lines are going to play out, for example, I'm fairly certain that Bran will also have to leave a certain cave quite hastily due to a White Walker attack, I'm not sure how it will play out there and if there will be a door or whatever. So I can still be excited to see how exactly it will play out, how exactly it will affect our characters and all that kind of stuff. The details will be different and everything is in the details. That's why I alluded to the show's failures, because in the failures you can see that they are arriving at certain plot points. For example, the Sand Snakes giving a certain dialogue to Varys and allying with Targaryens, but it really isn't the same, despite the logical endpoint more or less lining up. And it's the case in many, many of the plot lines. You may know that the wildfire under King's Landing is going to explode, but how will be wildly different in the books and in the show. And we are now at a point in the show where you really have to diverge between the two. If you do still conflate, that's my big lesson, you know, from season six. If you still conflate the books and the show at this point, you are simply robbing yourselves of the enjoyment that you can get from either. This is my take, basically.
I agree. And obviously there are book readers who are just like, I like the books, I don't like the show, I don't care that I'm robbing myself of enjoyment of the show, I just really prefer the books. And that's fine. I wish they wouldn't watch the show anymore, because it gets to the point of, like, derangement in a lot of cases. Like, I don't even remember what it was that made me stumble across this, but there's people who watch the show just to say things that are insulting to the point of, like, being actually a little bit alarming regarding the writers.
Yes.
Like, I would be alerting the police if I were them. Like, it's just like, and for what? Because they handled Brienne differently? Or Rickon? I don't understand. Just stop watching.
Yeah, you know, I also don't get it. You know, I just read a comment today under a review like, the Northern plotline has been so dumbed down because Benioff and Weiss, they think their audience is stupid. And I'm going like, no, they just didn't want to tell that particular tale. And this might be a good call or a bad call, but it is not like they do this on purpose to fuck you over, you know?
Yeah.
Game of Thrones is a show that is so complicated and so full of so many talented people. This is not The Walking Dead, where the writing team seems to say basically fuck you, and everything is always a shot reverse shot between two characters who have nonsensical dialogue. This is a show that is excellent in many scenes, at least from the production standpoint, which has stellar writing in most scenes, which has uniformly great acting. I mean, just look at the last episode when Dany and Tyrion had their heart-to-heart. It was pretty nonsensical, if you're honest, but they are so great actors. They sold a moment without any build-up, like other shows can dream of this after preparation of three seasons, you know? Mm-hmm. This is a show that is so well made. Never ever are they sitting there and going, ah, those sheeples, let's throw them a stupid plot. You know, that's not them. And they fuck up sometimes, but not on purpose.
I keep trying to think, like, are there other shows where the showrunners are treated like, and writers are treated like as personalized villains in the way that these people are. And I can't really think, probably to a lesser extent, Damon Lindelof, and an even lesser extent, Carlton Cuse on Lost by the end. But not, I mean, just the relentless insistence that you're reading, like, you know, that you know that Benioff and Weiss hate this, hate that, think this is stupid, think that's stupid, like, are, it's bizarre. And I also want to point out that this supposedly unforgivably dumbed down series is by many orders of magnitude the most ambitious thing ever to be put on television.
Yes.
I mean, it has more speaking parts than any other show on television. Surely has to be the most expensive show ever made, even adjusted for inflation. You know, people joke all the time about how hard it is to figure out who's who and who's where and what's going on. And the previously on Game of Thrones things run for like 2 minutes, you know, they have a map at the beginning of every episode just to remind you where the fuck everything is in relation to everything else. So yes. this is only, I mean, it's dumbed down compared to, you know, books, any one of which is longer than the entirety of the role of the Lord of the Rings. Sure, it's simpler to follow than that. But it's a different medium and has different needs. And it's not, they think they're stupid, so they've decided to eliminate the plot where Stannis goes from cave to cave contacting different, like, mountain clans. Like, maybe they just thought that wouldn't make for terribly interesting television, because it wouldn't, you know? Like, I don't know. It's very strange. And I don't know. I feel like I'm sounding like a broken record. I've made these same points over and over and over again for years, and nobody fucking listens, so what's the point? But
I don't think nobody listens. I mean, we have listeners out there. I think those points need to be made, actually, and they need to be made over and over again, because there's such an abundance of criticism, even from people I really value in their opinions on other matters, where I think they're wrong in this particular case. And what you just said about, you know, how ambitious the show is, I actually plan to write a larger and more thought out article on the issue in the near future. But really, Game of Thrones, if Game of Thrones shows you one thing, it is why George R. R. Martin takes so long to write the damn books. You have to keep in mind that they have, like, at most half a year to write the scripts for 10 episodes, and then they're in production. They can't have more than half a year. I guess it's even much shorter than that. And the time frame in which they are working is relentless and brutal. If you think that Benioff and Weiss have been producing Game of Thrones since basically 2010, I guess they have 2 weeks of vacation each year, and they're doing nothing else. This must be so grueling an experience. And how can you not have the occasional misstep if you are tackling a project that is this big, filming in 3 or 4 different countries at the same time, having so many speaking roles and everything? You are not always on hand to check the stuff for yourself, or you don't have time for reshoots. So if you find out later that something comes off wrong, let's say Jaime rapes Cersei and you didn't intend that, you can't really go back and make a do-over. It's not like you get a letter from Anne Grohl and she says, you know, George, this sounds really fucked up. And he says, oh, that was not how I intended. And he sends back a corrected paragraph for the print. This is a different beast entirely. And I think sometimes this fact gets lost a little bit.
I agree with you. You know, I was going to make a glib joke about how, well, they need to take that much time because they work so hard at deliberately punishing people who like Arya or Sansa or the Sand Snakes or Jaime or Brienne or, I don't know, even who the fuck is left? Theon, Jon. You know, it's hard to figure out ways to ruin the lives of people who like these characters. It's very time consuming.
Yes, absolutely.
So they gotta work around the clock. I mean, it's really difficult to marginalize the fandom, you know, in a deliberate way. And then, you know, I'm sure they have meetings where they need to go over, like, how much fun it was to bother these fans, and, like, you know, did they bother them enough? Did they not bother them enough? Like, was it an unsuccessful, you know, like, they have to do an after-action report, like, where we're like, we could have trolled people who like Melisandre a little harder. We didn't do a good enough job.
Like, I'm so glad that you didn't make that clip joke, you know?
No, yeah, it would be terrible if I had done that. So I'm glad
I think we're really losing subscribers right now.
I'm glad I avoided that, too.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is kind of, to get back to actually talking about the show and not talking about the conversation about the show, I think one of the reasons why they're talking about doing shorter seasons for season 7 and 8, I think they're talking about doing 7 and 6, 13 yes. episodes total, is that at this point, you're basically producing movies, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's minutes-long shots of the dragons in, you know, most of the episodes of the season. right? Like, and that alone is difficult. You know, and eventually you're headed towards dragons versus zombies, and at that point you literally may as well be making The Lord of the Rings, and they can't logistically continue to make that many episodes and continue to utilize that many storylines. So I think they were probably thinking about this long enough ago that when it came time to decide about Quentin Martell and fake Aegon and things of that nature, Victarion, they were like, we are just not going to have the wherewithal to follow those storylines into the final episodes of the show. So they didn't do them, you know. And I think that's also a reason why you saw such a massive die-off of characters in this.
Yeah.
In this, you know, all of King's Landing is gone. All the King's Landing characters are gone. Except yes, Cersei and her her direct minions. There's nobody left. And Jaime.
Yeah, and it bears to keep in mind that the same thing will happen in the books. We're just not there yet. But there is a great dying coming. I mean, if you just look at the list of POV characters, there have been several projections around the internet, very sophisticated ones, by the way, trying to assess how many POV chapters per POV character there will be in the Winds of Winter. And you just have to kill some of them. There is no way to make the math work. If you don't, so quite a lot of people will be dead by the end of the Winds of Winter, and the show is mostly already there. This is basically how the books will look, not in all the details, but it will be.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please add your point.
I had a piece that went up on Rolling Stone today, not the review. And not the countdown, not the ranking of all 60 episodes, which you can find on Vulture, which was a lot of fun to do. Yet another piece that talked about and just sort of gave it a big picture overview of season 6. And one of the things I said is that for all intents and purposes, unless something completely unprecedented happens, you have your final alignments of the factions at this point, right? You have Cersei firmly in control of King's Landing. You have the Northern Alliance between Jon, the Wildlings, the Knights of the Vale, the Lords of the North, and you have what I've been nicknaming the Axis of Female, which is Daenerys, Yara Greyjoy and the Ironborn Fleet, Ilaria Sand and Dorne, whatever they're calling. I don't know if it's House Sand or whatever. They probably won't bother. Olenna Tyrell and the forces of House Tyrell, the Dothraki, the Unsullied, the dragons, Tyrion, Varys, Missandei, Grey Worm, and, you know, whatever assorted forces they pick up from the now free cities of Slaver's Bay or the Bay of Dragons. So that's about it, right? Like, I mean, I know there's some wild cards. There's still Euron. He's the only one with really any kind of military force behind him. I guess there's the Brotherhood Without Banners and the Hound. Melisandre's out there. Brienne's out there. Arya's out there. But that's it. You know? You've got your pieces. You know, so that I guess is sort of my main kind of closing view of the season, which is that it seems to be like, for all the people who've ever complained, like, get on with it already, it's like, well, it's on now.
I definitely agree on that count. But as you mentioned him already, what did you think about Euron this season?
Euron, my friend Matthew Perpetua, who is a quiz writer for BuzzFeed, he pointed out to me that Euron this season is what Ramsay was a few seasons ago. They're setting him up, but not really paying him off just yet. They have to introduce him. They have to introduce him in a kind of dramatic way, but his real impact has yet to be felt. And that's kind of what I assume. Euron is a huge question mark for me. I know a lot of people feel a lot more strongly that they know what he's going to do or whose side he's on or what his motives are. I don't. I don't feel like I have a handle on it. I don't know what his what his plan is on the show or how it differs from his plan on the in the books or what, but he's the only major loose end out there anymore for the three alignments of characters, you know? So he's got to have some kind of big part to play.
And my big worry is that they basically used him to propel Yara and Theon to Meereen, which might be possible. I really hope they didn't, because that would be a letdown for me personally. It would be, of course, okay. I mean, he can come off as the Iron Islands Trump, you know, promising great things and then going down ignominiously. That's absolutely possible, and it will be definitely a departure from the books. It could even be great in the show, you know, like, whoops, here goes the fleet. I simply don't know where they are going with him. I expected to see him this episode, you know, episode 10. He was gone so long, but no, nothing.
Yeah.
That was a little bit weird.
Well, that's what makes me think they've got big plans for him, because he'll essentially emerge from hiding, you know?
Mm.
And then all of a sudden he's, you know, I kind of assume he'll sack Old Town. Because what else is Sam going to do down there? Read?
What do you mean?
I mean, there's nothing for him to do as a character if he's in Old Town by himself with Gilly and the baby and a bunch of books. True. Like, he needs something to drive his storyline. And I've assumed for a long time that's a big part of Euron's game plan in the book, so why wouldn't it be in the show? Now that we finally bothered to show Old Town,
gorgeous.
Yeah.
So gorgeous.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
And with Sam going through those library shelves and then coming into the big room with all the mirrors, all that was lost was like someone walking up to him with a pointed head and saying, "Welcome to Hogwarts, Harry."
You know? It was terrific. And one thing I wish I had a chance to write about in my review is that the impact of having the lights in the library have that same, you know, basically be like the spheres the way that the opening credits are. Like that gave this like extra punch. Like, I feel like even if you didn't recognize it at first, it's just like, oof, you know, that he's really at the heart of it all.
That's a great point.
Well, thank
you. That's really good. I hadn't thought about this.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this last time already, but the lighting on the show is stellar. What they are able to do with light, it is just wow all the time.
Yeah.
If it's Old Town Library, whether you have the rooms in Castle Black, you know, which are always like a little bit underlit, but with the backdrop from the windows, and the same thing in the dungeons of the Sept of Baelor, and especially when Cersei was crowned. I mean, who in their right mind gets crowned at night?
Yeah, I thought of that.
But
yep.
it was so fitting, you know, the whole imagery was so great, and her costume and everything worked in perfect unison.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that was, I thought of that, I was like, you know, I bet people are going to be picayune enough to complain that no one gets crowned at night, that's stupid. But it's like, you have to let the shit go and allow some room for poetry, you know? And allow some room for just what has the most impact, you know. I think the same thing holds true with the Battle of the Bastards and people complaining about how that, you know, the logistics of how that went down. It's like, it's not about logistics. Like, even Martin's text is not about logistics. He cares about, you know, strategy, and he cares about world building, and he cares about feasts and tournaments and genealogies and all these kinds of things. But like, he's not just writing Wikipedia entries.
No, he sets things up so stuff can happen,
right?
And then it makes sense. I mean, if you look at the stellar analysis that, for example, Stephen Atwell or Brendan Beefish and someone like a lawyer are doing on all those logistical military stuff, you see that Martin has obviously thought it through. But at the same time, it is always in the service of the greater narrative. You know, all those battles that are happening are telling stories. So sometimes pieces are moved into certain positions, not because it is very very sensible, and then we have to find logical solutions for it, and they're good at finding those solutions, and to Martin's credit, there's room for them. But still, it's not like the books would make them for us. And if you would be judging battles like in the show in good faith, you could also find many explanations for on the surface stupid stuff that is going on there. You know, I have been accused in the last weeks of projecting stuff into the script, which is not explicitly there, which is, of course, true. But at the same time, I think we are a little bit supposed to do that, and we're doing it in the books as well. And so talking about the Battle of the Bastards, this thing is really metaphorical. You know, and so it doesn't matter whether or not this phalanx could actually have moved that fast. That's not the point. They could have given a stupid explanation, and in the books there would have been a semi-comprehensible explanation for it, most likely. But you don't need it, and it would have fucked up the pacing in the show, which is so much different than in the books. So I'm rather glad that they go for the striking imagery and not so much for the logistics of it. Because really, if you look at, for example, the battles in the Lord of the Rings movies, they also don't add up most of the time. But it doesn't matter because it is giant and epic, and the score is,
I'm reluctant to even bring this up because I think it's over-discussed on both sides of the argument, but the speed with which people can get from place to place on the show relative to how long it takes in the books. I've seen people say, like, it's so good that the show has sped it up. And then I've seen people say, oh, it's so stupid that the show has sped it up. And it's
both,
like,
at the same time.
I don't think it's both, and it's also neither, because ultimately, who cares? You know? People get from here to there. The point is what they do when they get there, you know. I just don't. It just seems like a silly, wrong-headed thing to get worked up about, one way or the other. You know, I've literally seen articles where it's like, thank goodness they're taking so much quicker to get from place to place. Martin's books really got bogged down, and it's like, well, that was
no,
the
they
point.
Don't.
No, yeah, even if they do, that's the point. They don't get bogged down in terms of being boring. I don't think they're boring. I mean, characters get bogged down, and that's you get to wallow in this world, which I really love. But it wouldn't work as a show. It would not work as a show.
No,
so they did it differently, and I don't care. You know, I mean, and some of it also, I think people overreact. Like people who have been asking me, like, did Varys like warp from Dorne back to Meereen? And it's like, no. If you look at the fleet, it's half full of green Tyrell sails. You know. The Tyrells sent their fucking navy there. So it took some time for him to get back. It didn't just happen the next day. You know, people are so ready to take fault and take issue with it, but find fault.
I have to say, I also overlooked that.
Well, you know, this is what I'm for. I got the eagle eyes, man.
Much.
I got the eagle eyes.
You do. Yeah. You do.
I don't know. What else did we... What else do we need to cover here for season 6?
I think there is at least one major change that we need to talk about, and one omission. The omission being, of course, Lady Stoneheart. I think this season pretty much confirmed that she won't be in there. I don't see any place where she could show up now. But if you have a different opinion, I would be interested in hearing it.
Yeah, once you saw Beric and Thoros intact, I think that was the end of the dream of Lady Stoneheart, because maybe the show can. I can't think of another way to bring her back without using one or the other of those guys. And at this point, if they're both still around, she's been dead for literally years in Showtime. So there's nothing to bring back. You know, I briefly entertained the idea, like, well, maybe Melisandre will somehow run into her. But it's like, run into what? A skeleton? You know, there's nothing left. She's been dead for ages.
Okay, but if they wanted to bring her in, they would bring her in. I guess we can agree on that.
Yes.
I just don't see her narrative function at the moment. Because when we saw the phrase celebrating. I think that was the last conceivable moment where she would have a personal connection to make an impact. But since they gave that to Arya, well, what exactly is Lady Stoneheart going to do now? The Freys are all dead.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of abrogates the need for her on a narrative level, too. It's not just, again, it's not just the logistics. It's the, as a story, as a matter of story, there's not much to say. So, okay. Yeah,
so what about?
I don't think she's coming back. Sorry.
Yeah, I also don't think it. So the change I want to talk about is Jaime Lannister and Cersei Lannister. Yeah, there's also something that many people have gotten aggravated about, you know, like, oh, Jaime doesn't hate her. That's so bad. And I mean, okay, it's different for starters. They absolutely changed the trajectory of their relationship by 180 degrees. So the question is it a neutral change, a positive change, or a negative change, in your opinion?
Wait, so what is the change that they're like...
Cersei and Jaime are on really good terms for practically the whole of season 5 and 6 if you compare it to Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons.
I think that's fine. I mean, in all fairness, we don't see how Myrcella's death or whatever happened to Myrcella. Myrcella's not dead. Jaime wasn't involved. We don't see how that would affect them yet because they haven't gotten to that yet in the books. I don't mind it. I think it's realistic to think that, you know, as their world and their other loved ones sort of go to pieces around them, like they would reach for what's familiar and comfortable. At the same time, I don't think that's going to last now.
No, it won't.
She's like, first of all, she did the thing that he murdered the Mad King to prevent him from doing. And second of all, I feel like he'll probably, if push comes to shove, be uncomfortable if she were to actually advocate for him to marry her and become king, which I wouldn't put past her at this point.
That would be cool.
But I don't see how that goes over well with him. Or maybe it does. I don't fucking know. He's talked about it before. But.
Oh, I don't think it will go over well, because now he wouldn't marry Cersei. He would marry Cersei the Mad Queen, which is a kind of a different setup altogether. And I don't think he would accept it if she offered it. But I think it would be a cool development in their relationship, you know. Like, here, I finally offer you what you dreamt about all your life. The only thing you need to do to get it is to give up who you are. So how are you going to choose there, Jaime?
Yeah.
So I think this is pretty clever writing there.
I agree. I think there's a lot of like kind of low-key fallout that will happen next season. Someone pointed out to me that, you know, Tyrion is now in this alliance of convenience with Ilaria Sand. Will he still want to be in that alliance when he finds out what happened to Myrcella?
Huh.
You know, things of that nature. You know, Sansa's business with Littlefinger, and you know, could quite conceivably write to Sansa and Jon, send a raven and be like, "You guys know who tipped me off as to your dad's plans, right?" You know, if she's thinking clearly enough. But there's all kinds of stuff that could be done like that.
You're touching on quite an interesting point there that we haven't talked at all about, which is the White Wolf King in the North.
Yeah.
What do you think about that particular trajectory?
You know, I'm a big fan of the idea of the Queen in the North, so I was a little disappointed. I don't buy that she would be so easily susceptible to Littlefinger's manipulations as she was, but again... We're talking about one facial expression in one scene. We don't really know how that's going to play out. I don't really see her ultimately trying to usurp Jon Snow on behalf of, like, Littlefinger, you know?
I also don't see that.
Yeah, it seems unlikely. But then in that case, it's kind of a wasted little bit of drama that really has no point. I don't know.
I think we really, what is Sansa up to? I'm also very strongly in the Queen in the North camp, you know, and Jon Snow as King in the North now seems to me like a distraction, like a purposeful distraction, because in the same episode and right before we got the Lyanna reveal, you know, but Jon doesn't know yet.
Right.
So now he is basically going for Jon Stark. I am Ned Stark's son and the only surviving one to that, which makes me kind of the leader. I read this scene a little bit like a comment on the patriarchy of Game of Thrones.
Yes.
Because they are all proclaiming him and not even thinking about Sansa, you know.
Yeah.
She just sits there very uncomfortably. But no one even gets the idea. And for John, it seems like a moment long, he's also uncomfortable by this. And then he smiles insecurely and gets up and accepts the declarations. But really, I think when he will learn about his real destiny and all that kind of stuff, and after he got worked up about it, and after he went through all the shit that is by necessity going to get along with it, then he will have better things to do than to be king in the North, like riding a dragon and stuff. And you could easily say, so now you are my regent and heir, because I don't have a son anyway. I'm off on this dragon to the heart of winter. Good luck, Sansa. You know? And I think this is more or less the general direction in which this is going.
Yeah, I think there's a couple interesting things to point out here. Sorry, I said interesting. One of them is that Lyanna Mormont is the voice that nominates him effectively to be King of the North, and she's a little girl, from a house that is much more open to female inheritance and female leadership, and nevertheless, she selects Jon over Sansa. Now you could say, like, well, because she's used to siding with outcasts, and Jon as a bastard is an outcast, and that's true. But that complicates, you know, the neatness of the gender politics otherwise. And the other thing is this: Jon is the king in the North. He's just not a Stark king, you know?
Yes.
He's the blood of the fucking dragon. So there's some irony to that. And as you said, it's significant that they cut directly from the Lyanna flashback, where you learn that he's Rhaegar's child and Lyanna's child. Although you do not learn the nature of Lyanna and Rhaegar's relationship, because that part is strategically withheld by Whispering, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you are a time-traveling telepath. I feel like you can probably hear the Whispering, since you can travel through time. Maybe you can turn up the volume, you know? But they whispered that one part of the conversation where I assume she was like, you know, Rhaegar's okay. He's not so bad. Don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, because she wasn't actually raped, as best anyone can tell from the books.
I think what she whispers to him, people have turned up the volume, as far as I know. And it's something like, it's something like a robot would hurt him or something.
Well, that part I could hear. But there's a beginning part that she says before that.
Oh, no, I don't know what she said there.
Yeah.
And then might just be, yes.
Right. But anyway, so that seems significant, obviously. I mean, we all know it's significant. We all know what's going to happen with that. So, one final thing I would add is that I'm surprised the wall did not fall this season.
I'm not, really.
Huh.
I didn't expect it, to be honest.
I usually go one beat too far when I predict what's going to happen in a finale. I usually add one extra thing, and this was the extra thing this year. Last year it was Stoneheart.
Yeah. I didn't expect the wall to fall, because it would simply have been one big moment too many, because we clearly had the Battle of the Bastards. That was clear from the trailers, obviously, episode 9. And then we had Cersei's trial and Dany's march towards Westeros. So definitely something is something had to give. And I guess the wall will come down soon enough, but not yet.
Yeah. Soon enough, but not yet.
It's also still a question whether it will happen in the Winds of Winter or if it happens in Winds of Winter, but when exactly? Will it be the prologue? Will it be sometimes through? Will it be the epilogue? You know?
Right. And I think one thing that Game of Thrones as a show can do now is afford to mix up where it puts its climaxes. For one thing, it's going to be paced differently because the seasons will be shorter. So you won't have that, you know, episode 8 or episode 9, some real shit's going to go down kind of pattern to go by anymore. So it could, you know, for all we know, it'll fall in the season premiere next year.
That is very well possible, yes.
So it has a lot of leeway because it's so well structured, and it can get a lot of mileage out of changing that structure, you know.
That's true, definitely.
I think that's all I've got, man.
I'm not having anything on my plate right now as well. I'm sure as soon as we stop recording, something is jumping into my mind.
Well, I guess the final note is that vengeance is bad. Revenge is bad.
Yes.
Revenge is bad.
People disagree with me,
you gotta see the fucking horror show of any comment section where I write a piece about how revenge is bad.
It's
a nightmare. Revenge is bad. I don't know. To me, you cannot have such direct a parallel as the one that you have between Sansa smiling as Ramsay is eaten alive by dogs, Cersei smiling as thousands of people are blown to smithereens, and Arya smiling as she cradles Walder Frey's head in her arms as he tries to breathe through his slit throat with his stomach still full of his own children. You know? Yes. Like, I don't feel like... And people are like, well, you wouldn't say that about Jon Snow. And it's like, well, as a matter of fact, I've been saying it about Jon Snow for fucking years, ever since he cut off Jon O'Slynt's head. You know? Like, I realized, you know, I was like, kind of like, yeah, get him. And then I was like, that's fucked up. You know?
Yeah.
Of course you say that about everybody if you're a sane, rational person, if you ask me. So vengeance is bad. That's all.
I can only agree, man. I can only agree there.
That's what I like. That's what I like to hear. Well, thank
you. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So let's conclude this episode by honoring our time-tested tradition of thanking all of our patrons who submitted $10 or more per month. So just as a quick reminder, there is a Patreon going for us. You can find it on patreon.com/boiledleather. And if you are going to chime in, even a dollar per month helps. So everything is much appreciated. And there are cool pledges you can fill with stuff like questions answered by us and, of course, the mentioning here directly in a podcast. So let's just start this and thank everyone who pledged since the last time we thanked them. And I start with Rosie Gleason. Thank you very much for pledging at least $10.
Yes, Chris LaBianca.
Morgan.
Steve.
Tom.
Darren.
Another Morgan.
Two Morgans, holy shit. Colty.
Dave Morrissey.
Max B.
Anna Wojcik, I guess.
Sure. James Gentry.
And Emma Smith.
Thank you all so much. And honestly, thank everybody for supporting the Patreon. Again, it's patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Completely voluntary, you know, monthly subscription of any amount of your choice. The more you pledge, you can get some cool stuff, like Stefan said, mostly involving things that we will do involving your ideas here on the show. But there's some other things as well. And the more we get a month, the more you kind of get out of us in terms of more frequent episodes, better sounding episodes, and all kinds of stuff. Patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. We really appreciate it. And again, if you like the show, please tell people about the show. Go to iTunes, rate it, review it, subscribe, download. All that good stuff is very helpful to us. And that's about it, I suppose.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, everyone.
See you soon.
See you soon. Bye-bye.